We spent our 30th birthdays together. We were 9 months apart, but we took a day in the middle and used it for both of us. We cooked ourselves dinner at Justine's house, a child's meal of fongi pudding and coconut cake, although we also drank plenty of rum in the hope that it would make the next year easier. We did not say aloud what we wished for, though we wished for the very same thing. To board one of those sailing ships and cross the ocean. Late in the evening, after we had had too much rum, Justine wept for her daughter. I stayed with her until she fell asleep. I hadn't realized how lonely it was in her house at night, like a ship lost at sea. When it was past midnight, I walked back to town, up the hill, to the store. There was a certain freedom in being a widow. No one asked where I went or with whom I spent my time. Without my mother to keep an eye on me, I could do as I pleased. I wasn't afraid to be alone on the road. There were bats in every tree, but I waved my hands and drove them away as if I were a spirit. I had been young only a moment ago. I imagined that in the blink of an eye, I would be old, and my life would be over before I could make it my own. Perhaps my story would not end as I had planned. Or perhaps it would change into something I had never expected, so that years from now, looking back, I would realize just how little I'd known as a young woman, precisely as Madame Halévy had said.
Chapter 5. Mortal Love. Charlotte d'Amalia, St. Thomas, 1825. Abraham Gabriel Frederic Pizarro. He arrived at 14 Joannigan's Gata, in an area known as the Queen's Quarter, a day late after a season of storms, when so many ships were lost between St. Thomas and Charleston that the Indigo Sea was a graveyard of sails and masts. He'd been sent a parcel that contained the keys to the properties his mother's brother had owned, as well as all of those the same uncle had inherited from his father-in-law. Abraham Gabriel Frederic Pizarro was 22, but he was the executor of his uncle Isaac's will, and now the sole person to decide the fate of the business and of nearly a dozen relatives, all but three unrelated by blood. His family, some of who lived in Passy, just outside of Paris, and others situated in Bordeaux, where Jews had been recognized as citizens for 75 years, had met to decide the fate of the business. His grandfather, Pierre Rodriguez Alvarez Pizarro, was a Marano from Portugal, a hidden Jew whose family had lived in that country for several generations after fleeing Spain. After much debate, they had concluded that Frederic's youth would serve him well in undertaking the long, arduous trip and help him make the adjustment to the tropics. Not many among them wished to go into a region known for yellow fever and losses at sea. Frederic had read all of the accountings of his uncle's holdings, 2 houses, 1 store, and a failed shipping business. His uncle had left behind too many children and too many debts, all of which must be dealt with. It was up to Frederic to turn the situation around, as it was now a family enterprise, owned in equal parts by Isaac's widow, who had no voice in business matters, and the family in France, who did. This was the law and the way property was divided. Frederic was fluent in French and Spanish and English and Portuguese, which would be helpful despite his complete ignorance of Danish, the official language of what would be his new country, a tiny island he had never heard of before. Still, he was their choice. He was responsible, respectable, and learned in legal matters, the right man for the job. There had been several women in Paris who were displeased to hear the news of his imminent departure. After all, Frederic was tall, with dark hair and an easy gait, so handsome that women often chased after him, even on the street, much to his embarrassment, handing him cards with their addresses, inviting him to supper and tea. He always declined these offers of introduction. He didn't like the feeling of being hunted. He was something of a loner, and his dreams were filled with numbers and theorems. He believed in logic and had a mathematician's spirit, and he carried a memory of a section of Galileo's declaration with him. The universe cannot be read until we have learned the language and become familiar with the characters in which it is written. which is a mathematical language. Without these, one is wandering in a dark labyrinth. Some people said he was an angel, for certainly no ordinary man could act with such integrity, but he laughed when he heard these statements. He was flesh and blood. He lost his temper, made mistakes, knew fear, had wicked thoughts. At times, the intensity of his own desires unnerved him. They were under his control, but struggling to break free, it seemed, just beneath his skin, as if he might surprise himself with his grasp of pure pleasure, something he rarely knew. He burned for all he wanted, but ignored his yearnings, for he had a plan for his life, to prosper and be the man in his family that everyone could depend on. He wished to do this to honor his God, his faith, and his family. And so, when they'd come to him and told him he would be leaving France, he assumed this was God's plan. He was not an overtly religious man, but he was a believer in miracles, both small and large. The voyage had amazed and changed him. He had clung to the railings of the ship in the midst of storms and let the rain splash down on him. During one particular bad tidal surge, when the waves were 20 feet high, he closed his eyes and told his God to take him and do his will with him. When he opened his eyes to find he was still alive and had not washed away to a watery death, as two other men on board had, vanishing before anyone could lend a hand or a length of rope, he knew he had a future that was his to claim. He had left France as a young, naive student, but 3 months at sea with older, harder men had made the world seem like a different place. Dangerous, it was true, and mystifying, but open and fascinating, a book he had just begun to read. Perhaps fate was not written by God, but made by men. The first week he had been too ill to leave his bunk, sickened by the roiling sea and the metallic taste of the water from the barrel outside his door. But by the second week, when storms returned, he pitched in with the sailors and learned more in that 1 week than he had his entire life. He learned that rats and lemons could be eaten when there was nothing in the storeroom but molded bread, just as he discovered that the stars in the southern world were far brighter than any he had known, and that beneath the water there lived creatures so immense they created waves, as if they were masters of the ocean and of the universe and of fate. He gave into the world that was bigger and more mysterious than he'd ever imagined, and he gave up some of the control he'd kept over his nerves and his desires. People in Paris would have been shocked to hear how often he laughed, and how drunk he managed to get without falling on his face. He came off the boat with his beard unshaven and his hair so long it fell into his eyes. His leather bag of belongings had been discolored by salt, and his clothing was as filthy as any common sailor's. He was still too handsome for his own good. But with lines on his face now, despite his youth, formed by the salt and the sea, and tanned skin that was a harder covering when he'd realized he would need to survive. He knew no one in the town of Charlotte Amalia, or in St. Thomas, or anywhere else in this new world that was so bright he had to blink. The world was incandescent, on fire, and the gloom of his time at sea evaporated. He had been babied by his mother, a favorite of the family, encouraged by his teachers and mentors. Hardship was a story he'd read about, nothing more, until this voyage, which had let him know some of what the world was like. He now understood that the sea was enormous and bottomless. It was overwhelming and gorgeous and far beyond his control, just like the rest of life. He felt a fool to ever have thought he could predict his future, for he never could have predicted a country in which the steep mountainsides were red, where flocks of birds shook themselves from the trees like yellow flowers falling upward into the sky. He felt blinded by the tawny sunlight as he left the ship, and he quickly developed a squint that lasted the rest of his life. The heat was like a living thing that reached out in an embrace. If you fought it, you couldn't win. So he gave into it. That was what he'd learned at sea, not to fight the elements, or, he was still learning this, his own nature. He didn't bother dressing in a jacket, as he would have done in France, but instead ducked into a cobbled alley and slipped on the one good white shirt he had left, packed away for this occasion. He'd been told some men collapsed with heat prostration in their first instance on this island. Others slowly went mad, driven to drink by boredom or weather, taking shelter in taverns and the old Danish tap houses, where they fell prey to rum. But as he went along, all he felt was free. He stood on the dock and gazed along the shore, where the houses were built on stilts so tall they seemed like storks, their shutters painted bright hues of blue and yellow and green. Frederic had been ill as a boy, with lung disease. In the winter in Paris, he always wore two pairs of woolen socks and a heavy vest under his jacket. The heat here felt like heaven to him. He went along the road into town, passing several busy wharves, stopping under a vine of bougainvillea so he could listen to the bees. The hum was overwhelming. He could feel the buzzing going through him and lodged somewhere inside his heart. Perhaps he had never heard anything before he'd known the sound of these bees. He was a businessman, sent to set things straight and reclaim a failing business, a serious endeavor, and yet it seemed he had walked into a dream. He spied a donkey feasting on green stalks of grass and laughed so loudly that the donkey startled, then brayed and ran away. In his bag he carried a folder of documents along with the Bible. There was not a day that went by that he did not recite the morning and evening prayers wearing the skullcap he carried with him. He was a Sephardic Jew, whose grandfather had come from the little town called Braganza in Portugal, chased from his home in the middle of the night because of his faith, with no belongings and no destination. It was in Frederic's blood to travel. He took his prayer book from his bag and stopped in the road to give his gratitude to God for this day and for every day to come. The time was right to thank the Almighty. A star was appearing in the still blue sky. Evening was early to come here, and he hurried with his prayers. Two African men passed by him with a cart of fruits and vegetables, many kinds that Frederic didn't recognize. They were brown fruits, so sweet the flies buzzed around their bursting, ripening rinds, and orange ones that seemed to be tinted by a painter's brush strokes. Each fruit seemed a miracle, plucked out of a dream. "You look lost," the older man said. He spoke Spanish, the language that had always been spoken in Frederic's home. "Are you in the right country?" Frederic laughed. He gave the street name he wanted, and the fruit men pointed out the way. He spied some reddish fruit in one of their baskets, the only thing he recognized. The fruit seller said it was very rare in their country, and that an old man from Saint-Domingue had planted a tree in his courtyard, and it had grown so tall the fruit fell over the wall, and a few people had planted seeds from this one fruit, and now it grew in several gardens. They gave him one to eat, an apple, not crisp, but warm from the sunlight. It reminded him of home, and it was, by far, the most delicious thing he'd eaten since he'd begun his travels. "Are you looking for a woman?" the other African man asked him, switching to French. "Or just a place to stay?" "A place to stay," Frederic was quick to respond. "I'm not ready to be involved with a woman." "Who is?" the older man countered. They all laughed. Frederic was young and handsome. His Parisian French was so precise it was nearly a different language than the Creole spoken on this island. The men probably thought he was experienced with women, but he was not. His cousins went to whorehouses and had often insisted he go with them. On those occasions, he sat on a divan in the hallway and talked with a madam about her life and gave her business advice. He had ideas about everything and helped her to figure out ways to raise her profits. "You prefer men?" she said to him once. "I prefer love," he replied. "You are young," she'd shrugged at his naivete. "Come back in 2 years." Now, 2 years had passed, and he was in St. Thomas, where he knew not a single soul, but, if anything, was grateful for his aloneness. The world around him was an amazement more than enough to satisfy him without the intrusion of anyone close to him. In a dream, it doesn't matter with whom you are acquainted. All that counts is what you do and see. Here, every color was vibrant, a completely different palette than in Paris. The pale sky that had burned white with heat only hours ago when he'd stepped onto the wharf was now washed with pink and gold. A miracle, he thought, with more to come. Frédéric knew the widow had been sent a message concerning his arrival by the family, and that she had responded negatively. He had then been asked to write a letter, which he'd done, though there had been no reply. Perhaps she was expecting him, but he was filthy, in no condition to have a formal introduction. The fruit men led him up to what they called Synagogue Hill. They said his people mostly lived here and wished him luck. They told him to be careful. Some people thought the old Danish families that kept slaves could turn themselves into werewolves. They ate Africans and Jews for supper. They could run faster than any man. That was why some of the streets were made of 99 steps, so that the werewolf would stop to search for the 100th step, and while he did, his victim would get away. The streets were indeed steep, and Frederick's long legs were tired. He noticed an address he'd seen in his legal papers, one of the houses the family owned, empty now that the matriarch had died. It looked like the ghost of a house in the falling dark. He spied a spiral of smoke circling up behind the house and pushed open an iron gate so that he might see what was there. There was a skittering that unnerved him, the flash of some creature's tail. He thought of monsters and fierce animals of scales and teeth and claws. The air was perfumed and there was fruit everywhere, growing wild, untended. No one had lived here for some time. He went through the courtyard and opened another gate, painted green, which led into a rear street. There was a cottage before him, and a well-dressed black man was eating his dinner at a wooden table set out on a small stone patio. Or at least he had been having his meal until Frederick came through the gate. The fellow looked up, ignoring his food. Frederick saw the other man's hand move. There was a gun on his lap. "I didn't mean to disturb you," Frederick said in Spanish. He refused to believe it was his fate to be shot when he had just entered what he considered to be paradise. "I'd prefer if you speak French," the other man said. "Then if I have to shoot you, at least I'll understand your last words." More had happened to Frederick in the hours since he'd landed at the dock in Charlotte Amalia than had occurred in all the years he'd spent in France. "You don't have any reason to shoot me. Tell me why, and we'll see if I believe you." In elegant French, Frederick quickly explained that he had only just arrived and was looking for a place to spend the night before he went to meet the widow whose business he'd been sent to oversee. "So while you prepare to swindle the widow out of her business, you wish to stay here?" "I've been sent to run the business, not steal it. I would go there directly, but I can't present myself like this to a widow with 6 children.
7, Mr. Enrique said. "You're behind the times."
"You know the family?"
"You clearly don't. And now you want to spend the night in the house of a stranger you've never met before?" He gazed at the intruder and then shook his head. "Do you think you're clever enough to run a business?"
Frederick considered himself a good judge of character. At that moment, he didn't fear for his life. If anything, he felt more alive than ever before. "Do you always have dinner with a gun over your knees?"
"I'm the watchman here, among other things. The big house is empty. There are always thieves. You can stay there for the night. In the morning, I'll take you where you want to go. I think you'll need help on this island. This isn't France, you know. We have bugs that can kill you, let alone men."
Frederick gratefully accepted the dinner he was now offered. It was a stew called callaloo, made with taro, spinach, okra, and salted meat, a dish so savory with a flavor spiced with cloves and pods of cardamom that it loosened his tongue. He balanced his plate on his lap and swore he'd never had as good a dinner in France. He drank something sweet, a dizzying concoction called guava berry rum, and soon found himself speaking of intensely personal matters. Of his life in Paris and his family there, and of their expectations that he would return. He knew some men from the outside world hated this island. The weather, the informality of the people, the mixing of race and religion and station. But some men dissolved into it and became a part of it. They took the embrace they were offered. Frederick already knew he was of the mind of the latter group, those who felt they'd finally come home. He made his way to the empty house in the dark along the overgrown path that led through the garden. It was a stucco mansion with a stone foundation, with moss growing up along the stones. The scent of the flowers was dizzying. Pink blooms on vines snaked along the verandas and wound up the walls. In the hedges were nesting bananaquits, yellow birds that glowed in the dim shadows as if bands of sunlight had been painted across their chests. The front door had been left unlocked. The hinges groaned as Frederic pushed open the door and went into the spacious, cool hallway. A bottle of rum and dusty glasses were perched on a high mahogany table. He drank directly from the bottle. A lizard peeked inside the door, then ran into the hall, hiding under a rug. Frederic drank far too much. At home, he rarely had wine or alcohol and often had tea before bed. Here, he seemed unnaturally thirsty. It was late when he found his way upstairs and let himself into the first bedchamber he came upon. He pushed open the shutters, disturbing the bats in the courtyard, so that they all rose in a dark vortex like smoke lifting from the trees. Drunk, he fell deeply asleep. The pillows smelled like lavender. They were almost too soft, filled with the feathers of local birds, a thousand colors inside the cotton pillow sham. That night, he dreamed of Paris and of the rain. His dreams were gray and green, filled with shadows. When he awoke, the sun was blinding and his head was pounding from all the rum he'd consumed. There were pink petals on the stone floor, and the lizard was on the windowsill, a pale green thing with wide eyes, kingly, as if the house belonged to him. Frederic rejoiced to think that this was his waking life. He offered his gratitude to his family for sending him here. On the ship, he'd worried that he would fail them, that he would be better off at home, in the job he was used to, in the world that he knew. But now he understood. They had chosen correctly. He found clean clothes that were nearly his size in a cupboard. They were made of lighter cloth, linen and cotton, pale gray and white. He poured a pitcher of cold water over his head and shaved as best he could. His hair was longer than acceptable in Paris, but here he'd seen men simply tie it back, and he did likewise. He looked through his bag for a silk scarf he wore on formal occasions. "All set to rob the widow," Mr. Enrique said when they met up in the courtyard. There were blackbirds with green throats that were no bigger than moths darting through the air, lighting on trembling branches. "I'm here to help her. If I were a thief, there was plenty to rob in France, and I would have avoided the pains of traveling here."
"Well, I don't think she'll see it that way."
They walked down the hill to the commercial district, boots clattering. The streets were filled with the din of working people and with trills of birdsong. A fellow in the market sold tamed birds. Bits of yellow and pistachio green fluttered, contained in bamboo cages. Frederic wished he had the time to visit all the stalls and try everything before him, food of all sorts that he'd never seen before. The drinks offered had names that delighted him: pumpkin punch, peanut punch, coconut water, lemon tea. There was fruit on the trees, and in the distance the mountains looked red rather than green. It was May, and the first flowering of the flamboyant trees had begun. The air was thick with salt and the scent of limes. They passed a cafe where fishermen, already back from the sea, were bolting down their breakfasts. "Let's stop and get ourselves a meal," Frederic suggested. The fish soup looked especially delicious, and the scent of curry drifted toward them. Mr. Enrique threw his companion a look.
"There are some things you should know about this place."
He realized now how young and naive his companion was.
"Your people were granted full rights on this island, other than the fact that they cannot marry out of their race. But mine don't have that benefit. There is no selling of human life since the first part of the century. The Danish government saw to that when they took the island. But those who came here as slaves remain so. True, many people of color here are free, but that doesn't mean you can publicly sit down for a meal with me.
Frederic shrugged. We could take it with us.
I wouldn't be served at this establishment. We'd have to go down the street, and there isn't time.
Frederic laughed.
Because the widow is waiting, snoring in a chair?
He clearly had a vision of her, and Mr. Enrique gave him a hard look.
You should know the widow isn't old. She's not what you expect. She understands the business and is bright.
And you know this because...
I was her father's clerk, and then your uncle's clerk, and now it appears I'll be yours as well. That is, if she allows you into the office.
I am the heir to my uncle's estate, which includes her father's properties. I'm afraid she has no choice, Frederic informed his companion, his more serious side emerging.
That may be, but she'd probably do better running the business than anyone, if it was not against the law for a woman to do so.
They had reached the store, which was already bustling at this hour. Frederic admired the stone and stucco facade. Enrique explained that above the commercial area were the rooms where the widow and her children lived. This was just as well. The estate wished to sell the house where his uncle Isaac had lived and the house of his uncle's mother-in-law, where Frederic had spent the night. He thought of his dreams of rain and felt a chill. He had just turned 22, and all at once he felt his youth. How little he knew about the lives of others, widows, children, dying men. He was about to enter into the daily life of people he didn't know. He hesitated at the door. There was a hedge of those same pink flowers he'd seen in the stucco house, and the bees seemed to have followed him. He closed his eyes for a moment and listened to their buzzing, then suddenly felt he was being watched. He gazed upward, squinting, but all he saw were some lace curtains made in France. Once they were inside the main hall, Enrique directed him to the widow's lodgings before continuing on to the office at the rear of the store. Frederic went through a side door and took the stairs to the modest living quarters. In France, this would have been considered the home of a person with little means. He had the key to the place and was legally the owner of everything, but felt too uncomfortable to use the key unannounced, so he knocked at the door. Frederic heard people talking inside, the rise and fall of voices speaking French. He rapped on the wood again, and again there was no answer. He waited in the corridor for some time, long enough for him to realize no one would likely respond, and so he used one of the keys that had been sent to him. There was a click, and then the door opened into the world he'd been sent to manage and guide. He hadn't expected the scene before him. Two boys who were nearly men gathering some books, so many children at the table he could not count them all, an African woman seeing to their breakfasts, admonishing them for being greedy and late, a little boy and some even younger girls barefoot, their hair braided and pinned up. They were Emma and Delphine, so close in age they seemed to be twins. It barely mattered how many there were, he could not see any of them clearly as his attention was riveted on the woman who came out of a bedchamber wearing a white shift. Her masses of dark hair loose, a baby at her hip. He thought of a white rose, for there were some in his parents' garden outside Paris, blooms which grew on thin, wavering branches covered by thorns. The woman appeared to have just come from her bed. Her clothes were loose and light enough for him to see her form. He found himself immobilized, there on the threshold of a home to which he hadn't been invited, or it seemed, expected. A little girl saw him first and pointed. "Qui est cet homme?" she asked in a sing-song. It would take weeks before he could tell which one was Delphine and which was Emma. The rest of the children, who had been as noisy as birds, quieted, staring with suspicion. The black woman said, "What do you think you're doing here?" in accented English. They were all speaking to him at once, except the dark-haired woman dressed in white, who merely raised her eyes to his. She gazed at him coldly, not wanting him to realize how handsome she found him. There was a soulful cast to his features, as if he revealed his innermost self. She saw that he was wearing gray leather boots, and she knew he was from Paris. And at that instant, Rachel Pommier-Petit, who had the sharpest tongue on St. Thomas, found she could not speak. Frederic ignored the others and managed to walk up to the lady of the house and introduce himself. He could imagine what a fool he must have seemed to Miss Enrique when he spoke of her as if she were an old woman. He'd been warned that she was not what he expected. He managed to introduce himself and to say surely she must have received the letter stating he would be arriving from France. "My goal is to help you in any way I can," he assured her. "S'il vous plaît, permettez-moi de vous aider." The widow stared at him. His accent was perfect, careless and elegant. She laughed and said, "Before I'm dressed or after?" He realized she wore a chemise and a petticoat, not a white dress. He could not quite remember her name, but then the African woman called her Rachel, a familiarity that never would have occurred in France between mistress and servant. He recalled what he'd read in the files he carried with him. Rachel Pommier-Petit, born in St. Thomas, daughter of a well-respected shop owner named Moses Pommier, married to his uncle Isaac when she was not much more than a girl. The children had gone back to the business of getting ready for the day. The older boys continued to stare at Frederic, uneasy, perhaps, because he was not that much older than they, but the younger ones paid him no mind. He felt surrounded by mayhem, the children finishing their food, the maid, who was called Rosalie, clearing up as best she could, shouting out instructions that the children more or less ignored. Frederic could see only the woman before him. The rest faded away, sinking out of his line of vision. He would always think of the scent of molasses from the store downstairs when he thought of this day, the morning when he fell in love with a woman who had 7 children. "I had Rosalie go down to the boat to meet you yesterday, but you weren't there," Rachel told him. His posture was so straight, not like that of the men in St. Thomas who slouched in the heat. He stood the way she imagined all men in Paris did, with a natural grace. "I thought you'd changed your mind and stayed in Paris, which made me think all the more of you." "You've been there?" he said to engage her in a conversation that might make them less than uncomfortable with their situation, more social, if that was possible. "Not quite yet." When she laughed, she looked like a girl to him, no older than himself, though she was, technically, his aunt, and 7 years older. The amount of time that Jacob had served to win his Rachel in the Bible, though each year had seemed like a day because of the love he felt for her. "Well, I'm flattered that you thought of me at all," he said. "I didn't want to disturb you, so I imposed on your clerk and spent the night in your parents' house." "How quickly you moved into what was once ours. You've come from Paris to this dot in the ocean to claim what belonged to my husband and my father, and, if the laws cared anything for women, to me." There was color rising in her face and throat as she spoke. Clearly she resented him. She had begged Isaac's family in France to trust her with the business, and in response, they sent this tall young man who stood in her kitchen, surprised by everything he encountered. It was as if a heron had flown in through the window and then had frozen, shocked by the peculiar manners of humankind. Rachel studied him more carefully now, for he was equally strange to her. His Parisian accent, the way he ran his hand over his brow when he was speaking, his eyes, which appeared to change color depending on the light. Despite his youth, he seemed commanding in some way, comfortable with himself in a manner she assumed a man educated in Paris might be. She'd seen him from her window, and had immediately known he was the one, the man who'd come to take over her life. She'd taken note of how good-looking he was, how French in character he seemed due to his extreme composure. Well, face to face, he was no longer quite so composed. He plucked at a thread on his shirt. Rachel recognized his jacket and trousers. You're wearing my cousin's clothes, I see.
Am I? They're only borrowed. I'll give them back, of course. Certainly, I'm not a thief, I assure you. I'm here to help, nothing more.
This wasn't entirely true. The Petit family in France was claiming what was legally theirs, half of the business, and they wished it to prosper, so he was there for reasons other than assisting her, no matter how he claimed to be at her service. He was here for the family. Now that he stood before her, he felt somewhat pained by the legal arrangements he was sent to oversee. "Keep the clothing," the widow told him. "My cousin won't be returning. He's wise enough to stay in Paris, but please excuse me while I find my own clothes." Frederic waited at the table while the widow dressed and the children were sent off to school. He would have liked some tea, but did not ask for fear of overstepping his welcome. He wondered what sort of tea they drank here. Surely it was made of roses and jasmine, rather than mere black tea leaves. The maid put a cup before him, as if she'd read his mind. Lemon and ginger, sweet and sour.
"She's not going to like you," Rosalie told him.
The maid had the baby on her lap, but she kept her eye on him.
"So don't even try."
Rachel returned in a pale green dress, her hair knotted at the back of her head. It was the first time she had not worn her mourning clothes. Instead, she'd slipped on the dress Justine had made. She told herself the dress was the first thing she found in her bureau, but that was not exactly the truth. The dress had pearl buttons, as French dresses often had, and a crinoline trimmed with lace. No longer caught unawares, Rachel seemed different. More distant. Frederic wanted that other moment back, when she'd first come out of her chamber, unguarded, her hair falling down her back. There were thousands of women in Paris wearing silk dresses, but he'd seen not a single one in a white shift. "I presume you're here for business, so we should begin," she said to him formally. One of the children sang a bit of a song, and Rachel laughed and once again was the woman he'd first spied, her upturned face filling with light, her mouth dark and beautiful. He felt he was seeing a secret, a vision granted to only a few. He could feel his desire when she glanced at him. As she caught his eye, her expression had darkened. Perhaps she could read his thoughts, which were embarrassing even to himself. The things he wished to do to this woman, he could not have brought himself to say aloud. Rosalie went out with the children, and for a moment it was awkward between them, two strangers in a small room. The plates and dishes left on the table with crusts of bread and bits of fruit, flies gathering on the rims. The heat of the day was beginning. There was nothing and everything to say. Women were not supposed to be alone with men, but he was family, and so young, only a few years older than David, the household's oldest boy. Surely there was nothing wrong in being in the same room. She gave Frederic another cup of tea and accidentally spilled some on his hand. He couldn't have cared less. He let the pain radiate through him. It seemed all of his senses were heightened. Though he assured her it was fine and she hadn't burned him, she was unsure and placed a cool washcloth on his skin. His expression was unreadable. He didn't even seem to blink. There was a salve she could get for him. "It will just take a minute," she said. He told her please not to bother, he was fine. She took the cloth away and saw a blister rising. She could feel her concern, but also much more. Something far too hot. She felt as if she were the one who might faint. He was right. She must let it be. She turned her back to him and wrung out the dishcloth. She was thinking too much about him already. He looked like a man who had stepped out of a cold world in his gray boots, with his black hair tied back and his posture so straight, even though he'd been burned. "We should go," she said.
"We should," he agreed.
They went downstairs, and Rachel introduced him to Monsieur Farvel, who was now running the daily goings-on at the store. The air was so sweet, it was difficult to breathe. Soon, Frederic would learn that everything on this island carried the aroma of molasses, but for now, he equated the scent with desire. While the men spoke, Frederic took a cursory glance at the shop books, quickly spying dozens of errors. Rachel sat in a chair, her hands folded, watching him. He felt himself grow feverish under her glance. He gently pointed out a few errors to Farvel, who was not at all pleased to be upbraided by a stranger, and one as young as his own son. "You're good at numbers," Rachel said as they went to the shipping office at the rear of the store.
"I dream of them."
She laughed. "That's an odd dream to have. But who am I to talk? I dream of rain." The corridor was small and packed with boxes. There were dust motes in the air, some as big as moths. He could not keep his eyes off her. He wondered if it had been her bed that he'd slept in the big house, and if the dream he'd had had been hers. He had despised rain when he was in France, but now he longed for that rainy dream, for the bed that might be hers, the pillows that were so deep, the open window and the yellow morning light, and the cool green dream they had shared. She brought him to Mr. Enrique, who shook his hand and said, "Good morning, sir," as if they'd never met or discussed life on a personal level.
"Good morning," Frederic replied, quite confused about the intricacies of social expectations here. He understood that he should follow Mr. Enrique's lead and act as if last night had never happened, and they had never dined together and discussed their personal histories. In Paris, one's place in society was set. An individual did not have much to do with those outside his own position and faith. Jews were in a circle with other Jews, bankers with bankers, and so on. It all made perfect sense. Later, Frederic would understand that on this island there were the rules of what should be, and then the deeper truth of what actually was. People knew each other intimately, and then pretended they'd never met.
"First things first, Mr. Enrique is not to be removed from his position," Rachel told Frederic, although she had no right to give orders.
"Of course."
Frederic did not wish his stewardship to be unpleasant, and there was no cause to disagree. It was in his best interest to keep Mr. Enrique on. "And I need these papers signed immediately." Rachel shoved a document in front of him, which he scanned, trying to make sense of it, though she was hurrying him along, handing over a pen, pointing out the place for his signature. When he hesitated, she put her hands on her hips. "I see you don't trust me, but I'm sure you will expect me to trust you," she said.
"Is business about trust or knowledge?" Frederic asked. "I'm here to do what's best for you."
"This is best. These papers allow Rosalie to be a free woman. I haven't the right to do the signing."
Now he understood. Rosalie was a slave. He supposed she was, in essence, part of his uncle's estate. Not that there was any reason for the family in France to be notified of this, for it was a violation of the deepest human right. Rachel was watching him carefully, and he could tell this was a moment in which she would either praise or condemn him. He already knew he didn't wish to lose her.
"Of course," he said once again.
When he glanced up, the widow and her clerk were exchanging a pleased look.
Frederic handed her the document. She did not thank him, but rather studied him more closely than before. She was staring at his jacket. It was as if she could see beneath his clothes.
"I presume you gave him my cousin's clothes," she said to Mr. Enrique in a teasing tone.
"He wasn't given them. He took what he wanted, though he swears he's not a thief." Mr. Enrique and Rachel often shared jokes, and they did so now, at Frederic's expense. "You should be careful that he doesn't take too much from you without asking."
Rachel turned to glance at the nephew of her husband, the young man from France who was too handsome for his own good, who dreamed of numbers, who took what he wanted, and who now hung his head, embarrassed at the very idea of being judged untrustworthy, even if they were merely having fun with him.
"What do you have to say for yourself?" Rachel asked him. "Do you plan to steal from me?"
She said so to taunt him, but all of her intentions took a turn when he raised his eyes. His look went through her. His eyes were some color she couldn't define, a gray or green. They were the color of rain. She hadn't known rain could have a color. She'd thought it was clear, but she'd been mistaken.
"I would only take what you offered," he said. Rachel was impressed by his forthrightness and not at all offended, as another woman might have been. If anything, she felt her interest deepen.
Something had come to her from Paris at last.
Frederic was quickly granted his burger brief by the business association, which allowed him to take over his uncle's holdings and be accepted into the community. He lived in a spare room in the store, below the apartment, beside the office where he worked. It was expected that he would move to his own lodgings when a property became available, not that he was in a hurry. He didn't even look for other accommodations or respond to suggestions offered by the men of the congregation who knew of boarding houses and rooms to let. He said he was too busy, and his time was taken up with his uncle's business matters. But the truth was, he did not wish to go anywhere else. In his current room, there was a single window that let in more sunlight than had streamed through all of the windows in his family's home in France combined. Here, every day was a joy, bathed in light. Banana quits nested outside his window and woke him with their song. Yet no matter how hot the weather, every night he dreamed of rain. It poured down in his dreams, and when he woke he felt much as a drowning man pulled from the sea might have, as air rushed back into his being. Inconveniences did not matter. He did not care for luxury. There was an outhouse beyond the shop and a wash basin on the dresser. He shaved only every other day and tied his hair back with a string of leather. He sold the houses first, which paid off debts and gave the business a tidy sum to invest. Rachel came with him to walk through the empty houses. First they went to his Uncle Isaac's house. There was an echo on the tile floors, a thickness to the air. She stopped on the threshold of the chamber she had shared with her husband and held out her hands as if in some sort of prayer. Frederic stood beside her, his throat raw. "She's gone." Rachel's expression was grave, her black eyes piercing. "She?" Frederic asked, thinking he must have heard incorrectly. Surely it was his Uncle Isaac to whom Rachel referred. "The ghost." "Ah," Frederic said, relieved that she was not still mourning her husband. "So the house was haunted. You don't believe me?" Rachel threw her shoulders back as if ready for a fight. "She was his first wife, the one he loved." "He loved you," Frederic said before he thought better of it. "Why would you say that?" Frederic shrugged. "Because he'd be a fool not to." They walked along the empty loggia that adjoined the rooms. All the furnishings had been sold and taken away. There was a poppet in a corner, a child's toy. "You've seen the way he managed the business." Rachel's voice was soft. It was terrible to walk through an empty house, lost by mistakes of fortune. "Maybe he was a fool." "Well, I'm not," Frederic said simply. They went out to the porch, then down to the gate decorated with herons. The sky was opalescent. Rachel shielded her eye so that she might look into his. Doing so was like stepping into the rain. Mr. Enrique was given the title of manager, and in return he worked long hours, teaching Frederic the business. He was a good teacher, and as talented at numbers as Frederic was. Rosalie often brought them their dinner when they worked into the night. It wasn't long before Frederic realized there was something between them, a tenderness brought by years of intimacy. "Your wife?" he asked one evening. "Is that your business?" Enrique turned away, and Frederic dropped the subject. Later, as they were closing up the office for the day, Enrique said, "I had a wife once, but we argued. Now I don't know if she's alive. This was all on another island, another lifetime. So how can I marry?" They kept their attention on the ledgers after that,
for a discussion of one's personal life could lead to trouble. They both agreed that the store was the most profitable piece of the estate, and they concentrated on increasing the importance of sales, as Mr. Enrique suggested, for the shipping business was besieged by bad weather and pirates and taxes. Fate was a terrible business partner, Mr. Enrique told him. Frederick took his manager's advice in all things. They would sell molasses and rum, and let other men take their chances on shipping and ruination. When he wasn't careful, Frederick dreamed of Rachel. He kept his distance. He heard stories about her at the synagogue. He overheard other women say she thought too highly of herself, that she spoke her mind as if she were a man, and was never polite to the other ladies. He walked away from such conversations. It was none of his business, anyway. Still, when members of Blessings and Peace invited him to dinners, he had little choice but to attend. They were formal events, and he had only one black suit, which Rosalie pressed for him every time he went out in the evenings. He realized he was being introduced to all of the unwed young women and girls. At one dinner, he was so overheated and nervous that he went into the courtyard, taking a glass of rum with him. It was even hotter outside, but at least he was alone, or so he thought. At first there seemed to be a heron on the patio, one of those strange blue birds he had spied in the marshes. Then Frederick realized it was one of the older women from the congregation, wearing an azure-colored dress. "Do you know what a sin is?" the old woman called to him. "Pardon?" he said, taken aback. He waved away the moths that seemed to be attracted to the hair tonic he used. "It's what you want and know you cannot have." It was Madame Halvey. "Are you referring to the rum?" he asked in an amused tone. "I'm referring to desire," Madame Halvey said. "Well, thank you for your interest." Frederick was doing his best to keep his wits about him. He thought perhaps he had run into a mind reader. He had heard there were such women on this island. "It's not interest." The old woman signaled him to help her up from the stone bench, and he had little choice but to do so. "It's a warning," she went on. "So you understand, there is a covenant against incest." "Madam, I'm sure I don't know what you're talking about. As a brother cannot lie with a sister, nor a father with a daughter, neither can a nephew and an aunt. You do not need to share blood to be in the same family." He felt like thrashing her, old bones and all, but was polite, as he had been taught to be. "I don't know what would make you say such a thing," he said in a cold tone. "Rachel makes me say such a thing," Madame Halvey said. "She has never understood she must obey the rules. For both your sakes, I'm hoping that you do." He helped the old woman inside, then fled from the congregation. From then on, he kept to himself. The old woman's warning had made him re-examine his actions. Now, when he had free time, he explored the island. He swam in a waterfall that Enrique mentioned, a secret place set in a marshy area that was a nesting place for herons. Frederick's first real bath, not one from a wash basin, was had among tiny blue fish that flashed around him. He quickly accepted the local wisdom that it was better to drink rum rather than wine. Rum kept away diseases, as did the netting that he strung around his small bed. Sometimes he went back to the place where he'd heard bees on his first day in Charlotte Amalia. He closed his eyes and listened to the thrum as bees darted among the flowers. And despite his resolve not to do so, he thought of Rachel. When he visited his uncle's widow on Friday night after services, he was schooled in the proper way to hold a baby on his lap while he took his dinner. He tutored the boys with their schoolwork, and thought David had an especially good head for numbers. He told himself, and anyone who might bother to ask, that he went to the Friday night dinners to be polite, and because it was his duty, and because in some way he was now the man of the house. At these times, and at all times, he did everything he could not to look at Rachel or imagine her in her white shift. And he seemed to have memorized that garment, the seams, the pearl buttons, the way it fit her body, the way he might undo it and tear it off her body, the way she might beg him to do so. He was furious with himself for thoughts he could not seem to control. She was 7 years older than he, and had lived a lifetime in those 7 years. She had been a married woman, a widow, a mother, and he was nothing more than a young man who was good at numbers. Once, after leaving, he stopped on the street and glanced into the window. He saw her unpin her black hair. He stood there, even though he knew she would remove her dress. It was as if his imagining had been willed into being, and he couldn't turn away. Those next few movements, when she stepped out of her clothes, undid him. He could not look away. He heard bees somewhere, but he couldn't have told whether they were beside him in a hedge or halfway across the island. Afterward, he walked through town and then into the hills. He trekked for miles and miles, hoping he could walk away his thoughts. He found himself lost in a meadow. Everything was pitch. He felt alone in all the world, more so even than when he was at sea, where no one would have known if he slipped into the waves. He panicked when he saw eyes staring at him through the dark. He thought he had come upon the devil, and that the devil had been the one to give him the thoughts he had about Rachel, and now he would be punished. But when he looked more carefully, he saw it was only a goat, kept behind a wooden fence, staring out at him. He laughed at himself and his fears then. He had told Rachel he wasn't a fool, but now he appeared to be one. One evening at Friday night dinner, Rachel touched his hand with hers while passing him his plate. It was nothing, a passing stroke, yet his flesh burned. He did not care to have his meal. He saw her later pouring cold water on her own hands, and then, quite suddenly, he knew she felt as he did. After that, he worked harder, kept later hours. He wrote to his family in France long letters about the business and did not mention her. At night, he listened to the whir of mosquitoes and moths. He felt the blue-black darkness all around him. He wished that when he awoke, he would find that he'd forgotten the first time he saw her. There was a night she came to his room when he was asleep. He was dreaming that she was there in her white petticoat, and when he opened his eyes, there she was, holding a lantern. She whispered, "Hurry up, get dressed," then went into the corridor to wait for him. He leapt from bed and pulled on his clothes, hurrying to see if she had been real or the work of a fevered brain. He carried his boots and darted into the corridor. She laughed when she saw him rush from his room so tall and lanky and disoriented, wiping the sleep from his eyes. "You look like you expected something else," she said, for she was fully clothed in her green dress, and she wore a light cape. Her amusement made him slightly angry, or perhaps it was the pure hurt he felt when he thought about the fact that she had belonged to his uncle, an old man who had ruined the business. "You came to me," he said coldly, then instantly regretted his tone. "So I did," she nodded, chastised. "I don't deny it." It was as though everyone else in the household had disappeared, magicked away in the blue night. Rosalie lived with them during the week. She slept in her own room when she cared for the children, the door open so she could hear the babies if they woke. All were asleep. No one seemed a part of this world, except for the widow and her nephew. The air was heavy, enchanted, and the frogs made a singing noise that was urgent and low. A few days earlier, Frederic had discovered a frog under his pillow, green with a red dot on its back. "Poisonous," Rosalie had declared when he described the creature at breakfast. "You'd better watch out for yourself. This isn't Paris." He'd learned later on from the children that this wasn't true. The frog was harmless
and Rosalie was having fun with them. Now, every time Rosalie saw him, she said, "Are you watching out for frogs?" It had become something of a joke between them.
But his uncle's widow, leaving him out into the dark night, was not a joke. He thought he could hear his own heart, and he hoped she couldn't hear